time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning, Jill Lepore. Jill Lepore is professor of American history and chair of the history and literature program at Harvard University. She is an elected member of the Society of American Historians, for which she serves on the executive board, and a distinguished lecturer of the Organization of American Historians. She is a staff writer at The New Yorker and co-founder of the magazine Commonplace. She is also the author of multiple books, including The Name of War, King Philip's War and the Origins of American Identity, New York Burning, Liberty, Slavery, and Conspiracy in 18th Century Manhattan, Blind Spot, a novel co-authored with Jane Kamensky, and she is here to talk about her latest book, The Whites of Their Eyes, The Tea Party's Revolution and the Battle Over American History. Jill, thank you very much for coming and spending time with us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Start out and tell us, what was the motivation in writing your new book, The Whites of Their Eyes?
Well, I teach an American Revolution course at Harvard, an undergraduate research seminar, and I was teaching it for the first time beginning right when Barack Obama was inaugurated in January of 2009, and taking my students on field trips in Boston and visiting graveyards and grading papers on the Battle of Bunker Hill and the Boston Tea Party. And meanwhile, you know, I would get home from work and watch the evening news, and there would be people dressed up in tri-cornered hats and knee breeches calling themselves the Tea Party and arguing that the country was enduring taxation without representation. And I was just sort of overwhelmed by, I was fascinated by this, both that so many people suddenly were so interested in the American Revolution, which I just got to say, it's kind of a hard sell on a college campus. It's hard to get people to take history courses to begin with, but everyone wants to take like 1968 to the present so they can, you know, watch Dylan concerts and, you know, read about Timothy Leary. So that so many people seemed suddenly seized with a passionate interest in the American Revolution was of course interesting to me. And so I just, you know, I was paying a lot of attention to this, and my students were also interested. And, you know, here we were in Boston, where the dumping of the tea originally took place December 16th, 1773. And this was this growing national movement that was kind of dynamic and, you know, of increasing importance to what was going on in American politics. And so I watched it, you know, for a year. And then in January of 2010, a year into the movement, Scott Brown, who was a Republican candidate, won the U.S. Senate seat that had been vacated by the death of Teddy Kennedy, Massachusetts, our longtime Massachusetts senator. And the Tea Party in Massachusetts claimed that victory, you know, plausibly, because they had worked really hard to get him elected. And in Massachusetts, is a very surprising thing for a Republican to win any office, but to win Teddy Kennedy's seat was an extraordinary thing. So suddenly I was like, wow, this is not just, you know, a national movement that I'm kind of watching with curiosity and thinking about. This is really a local thing, too. This, you know, this movement has a lot of power and big following here in Massachusetts and is really shaping politics locally. So I decided that I wanted to, you know, find out more about it, because what I got the sense of from reading about it was that the understanding of American history that people in the Tea Party had was at quite significant variance from the understanding of American history that I have as a historian, as someone who studies and teaches this era in American history. So I decided to go hang out with people in the Tea Party and went to a bunch of meetings in Boston. At the time, the Tea Party, Boston Tea Party, was getting ready for Sarah Palin's visit. She came to Boston in April of 2010. So it was a really interesting moment in the Tea Party in Boston. And so that's, I ended up spending a lot of time with these people, talking to them, trying to understand where they were coming from. And, you know, these people were uniformly open and curious to talk to me too. So it's a really interesting experience. And I wrote an article about it, and I just felt like I had a lot more to say. So I ended up writing the book.
All right. So talk to us about some of the things you have learned about the Tea Party movement from actually speaking with members there.
Well, you know, this seems like a cagey thing to say, but it's really impossible to make generalizations about this movement. And I think one of the reasons for the anger on both sides and the sense of paranoia about the representation of the movement is that it really is quite a diffuse and dynamic movement, and what brings people into it varies considerably. I also think it's changed a lot in the you know, year and a half since it started. A lot of the people I talked to were basically fiscal conservatives. They were Republicans. I talked to some guys, some sort of like white ethnic Boston guys who were one-time Democrats but had abandoned the Democratic Party some years back. Most of the people I met had never been involved in politics before. And this is a common thing, that even nationwide, when you, you know, just read reporters who spend a lot of time with people in the Tea Party, you know, never been involved in politics before. They'll say, you know, but the federal government is out of control. Our liberties are in danger. And I think this was very genuinely felt, but I frequently had the experience of, you know, hanging out in a bar, talking to these guys and taking notes and everything people said to me. And someone would say something to, you know, seemed so earnest and so sort of powerful, you know, I don't care what they do, Democrats, Republicans, just keep your hands out of my wallet, or, you know, something that they would say, and it seemed forcefully stated. And then I would go home and I would be like, you know, checking out stuff from Fox on YouTube. And it would have been something that was said earlier that week by Glenn Beck. And so it's not that this guy, you know, who said whatever he said to me in a bar wasn't believing what he said, but there really was this tremendous rhetorical force of the message that was coming out of Fox News. Each and every powerful thing that someone said to me, I could sort of be traced back quite clearly to some sort of sloganeering moment that had come most often from the voice of Glenn Beck. I was really interested to see that almost uniformly everybody I met, and again, like, I talked to like a small number of people in Boston. I'm not a gumshoe reporter. People have done such good work doing this, kind of talking to people, but I talked to a small number of people, but people do not read the newspaper. One guy said to me, I don't read books, I read blogs. People got their news from Fox. This has been borne out in national polls, where the people who were sympathetic to the Tea Party disproportionately get their news from Fox compared to the general population. People read blogs, and they read, you ask them where they get their ideas about American history, well, they do get them mainly from blogs, actually. Or they get them from organizations whose history they know very little of. Like this one guy who's like this very nice guy, software engineer. You know, he'd been registered independent, but was basically a Republican. And he was on and on about his liberties being in jeopardy. And he handed me one evening this pocket copy of the Constitution. And, you know, you got to just see, you can see right here, we're losing our liberties. And, well, you know, I have read the Constitution, you know. You know, so I was looking, I was fascinated. Like, what is this, like, little, it's like the guys on the street who want to hand you, like, the world is coming to an end pamphlets. And, it turns out this thing was published by the National Center for Constitutional Studies, which is now in, I believe it's now in D.C., but it started in Utah, and it was originally called the Freeman Institute. It was founded by this guy, Cleon Skousen, who worked for the Hoover administration in the 1950s, wrote a book called The Naked Communist, was disavowed by the Mormon Church for the extremity of his religious views, wrote an American history textbook called The Making of America, in which he referred to black children as pickaninnies and said that slavery was very hard on slave owners. The book was banned in California after it was introduced somewhat surreptitiously. He wrote a book that many people in the Tea Party urged upon me called The 5,000-Year Leap, in which he discusses the Constitution as divinely inspired and miraculous. The book was republished a year ago with a preface by Glenn Beck. Glenn Beck writes about this book as having occasioned his rebirth as basically a person whose new religion is history, is American history. So this software engineer, he hands me this thing, this little, you know, pocket Constitution, because for him, you know, he's concerned about the healthcare legislation because he thinks it's unconstitutional. But what he's handing to me is contained in this little document, the entire history of 20th century conservatism in America, like very far right. Skousen was the guy who founded the Utah chapter of the John Birch Society. So it's not, this guy's not telling me I endorse John Birch, but he doesn't have a sense of, what's come together in this movement, or what some of the influences are on this movement. And that's why I say it gets hard to make generalizations about people. Like, this guy's not really in some sense accountable. I mean, he wants to tout the Constitution, but that kind of strict constitutionalism in American cultural history has a really interesting history that people in the Tea Party movement, you know, are unsurprisingly not aware of. And maybe I think would be concerned if they were.
The U.S. Constitution, to many people, appears to be a sacred document. Can you talk about that? It's not just the Tea Party that considers that so?
Well, it's not just the Tea Party. On the other hand, viewing the Constitution in that way has a particular history. people who drafted the Constitution didn't think about it that way. They did not think about themselves as prophets who were divinely inspired, who were writing something that had basically come from the hand of God. They thought about themselves as dedicated public servants who were undertaking a tremendously important experiment in Republican government. And they had an honest and thoughtful sense of the fragility of that experiment. They were exasperated by the compromises that went into that document. People, especially Northerners who understood, who had some sense of foresight about what the consequences of the three-fifths clause would in fact be. Getting the Constitution even ratified by the states was a very hard sell. There was a very strong anti-federalist movement. You know, in 1787, 1788, No one thought that God's hand was at work in the drafting of this document. This was an interesting political moment. This was the most important political moment in modern history. This was, you know, the United States' great gift to political theory was really the Federalist Papers arguing, defending the system of government and explaining where it came from and what ideas it was putting forward out into the world. I mean, it is something to be celebrated and to be studied. Absolutely. Revering it as something that I can really maybe trace to the Second Great Awakening in the 19th century, the sort of tremendous religious revival that's often thought of as having been sort of a reaction to the Enlightenment, which is quite a secular moment in intellectual history, when the generation of Americans who were like, the guys were like, oh, so our fathers are the guys who waged the revolution, like, what are we? You know, like, they were just seized with a sense of inadequacy about imagine what that would be like, you know, like, oh, right, we're the people that followed the founding fathers. the sort of culture of reverence introduced itself there, but that was always mitigated by this. What the Second Great Awakening also produced were evangelical Christians who were fervently, fervently dedicated to the abolition of slavery. The abolitionist movement in the North was really, to a large degree, an evangelical Christian movement. And what those evangelicals wanted to do was to fix the Constitution, not to revere it. So you have, you know, William Lloyd Garrison on July 4th, 1854, burning a copy of the Constitution before a huge anti-slavery crowd, grinding the ashes of the Constitution under his heel while crying out, you know, calling it a covenant with death, while this, just, you know, group of worshipers essentially cry out, amen. I mean, there is a tremendously important tradition of dissent. And it's in fact a Christian tradition of dissent against the Constitution as a flawed document, as a document, you know, as a document that comes from hell. I mean, Garrison's rhetoric is incredibly powerful. So, you can find people in the 20th century and in the 19th century who want to revere the Constitution as a sacred document, but you can equally well, and certainly in the 19th century, I think, more easily find a strong and passionate, indeed, in a Christian tradition of dissent.
As well, the reverence for our quote unquote founding fathers. Talk a bit about that. That term didn't actually come out for quite a while.
Yeah, people talked about the founders a lot, and it isn't, in other words, especially Washington's death in 1799 unleashed a great national lament, you know, that this greatest generation was passing. And then the next moment where you have that is in 1826. You know, remember that on July 4th, 1826, the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, Jefferson and Adams both die. You know, and it's the whole nation mourns. Those two moments are really important for Americans trying to wrestle with what it would mean to move past that generation. And Washington in particular, you see a lot of veneration for Washington at the time of his death. But, you know, even Abigail Adams is one of these people, one of many people who's really concerned about what that means. Like, you can't actually, like, this is why we got rid of the king. Like, the king and his divine right to rule, that was the problem, right? That's the problem that the American Revolution solved. So to turn around and venerate Washington, you know, Abigail Adams said, you know, this country cannot have a savior. Like, that just defies our political philosophy. So there has, even though there has been a lot of kind of popular culture veneration on and off over the years, there's always been a countervailing force. And so the term founding fathers is something that Warren Harding introduced in the 19-teens. And he's really, he says the founding fathers were divinely inspired. And he's, you know, kind of unpopular guy who's using this claim to buttress his own political candidacy, you know. to give himself a kind of political authority, which is generally what the maneuver of reverence for the Founding Fathers has to do with. It's all about your own political authority, and it often comes from a position of political weakness, I would say, to call upon the Founding Fathers. Like, your ideas are not good enough, but if you just kind of say, well, they were also Thomas Jefferson's ideas, somehow now you're brilliant. It's a very old move. It's a longstanding part of our political tradition. I don't think it's necessarily a good one. But what Harding was competing against was the 1920s was the great era of debunking. The word debunking was coined in the 1920s because there were so many biographies of the Founding Fathers that were like, actually, these guys weren't so great. And then you have Charles Beard and his work in the 1930s saying, you know, the Constitution is basically a bunch of white guys arguing for their economic self-interest. And so you have a lot of cynical 1920s and 30s debunking of the Founding Fathers, that's sort of a response to things like the kind of coining of the term Founding Fathers. So in other words, there's no sort of straight lineage where we just increasingly worship these guys or something. It's always a back and forth. And that's actually perfectly healthy. I mean, we are a nation founded in revolution. That's an unstable origin story. It's going to constantly be written and rewritten and rewritten. Do I think the Founding Fathers were divinely inspired and that we should worship them? No. I had this interesting experience where I was on a panel with Dick Armey, who's the head of Freedom Works, the former House Majority Leader, co-wrote The Contract with America with Newt Gingrich. And he said, I don't know, we just had a very nice chat with him and really enjoyed being on. I was on a couple different panels with him. And at one point he said something like, well, you know, we... red-blooded Americans, you know, unlike certain Harvard professors, intellectuals, you know, we have the decency not to question the writings of great men. And aside from the fact that I do have red blood and I eat meat, and to question the writings of great men is actually historical investigation. Like, that's actually what we do. That's what history is actually the interrogation of documents. And so, you know, taking the time to sort of patiently explain that, like, this is not irreverence, because reverence is antithetical to humanistic inquiry, right? Like, that history is not, in fact, a religion. It's a humanistic, it's a field of humanistic inquiry.
Talk a bit, if you would, also about one of the things one hears from Glenn Beck and some members of the Tea Party movement is that this nation was founded on the idea of Christianity. What's your take on that?
Well, I do think it's important to be fair to say that a lot of the critique of the currently popular academic version of American history, which is Glenn Beck and others will say, you know, American history has been taken over by left-wing academics who are teaching godless irreverence and who have excised Christianity from the story of American history. And who don't sufficiently revere the Founding Fathers. Like, that's a big piece of the critique, right? Like, that's not entirely without foundation. It certainly is the case that, since the rise of the New Left in the 1960s, historians have been much more interested in ordinary people, in groups and in conflict, uncovering the history of slavery in greater detail, understanding the relationship between liberty and slavery historically, have not actually paid a whole lot of attention to great men. There's, of course, a powerful critique of great man scholarship as a field of, as a way to do history that emerged in the 1960s. So that a lot of the scholarship written in the last 40 years has, in fact, not been about the Founding Fathers. It's been about artisans and slaves and women and children and paupers and how, you know, 18th century poorhouses and, you know, printing trades, and there's a lot of other things to study besides these five guys who are, like, you know, the superheroes. Which is to say, it's not without foundation for Beck and others to say, well, you know, American historians no longer teach the greatness of early Americas. They don't look at these great men anymore. I think that's to some degree a fair criticism. And so then similarly, the criticism that, well, you know, academic historians have excised the history of religion and history of Christianity and the importance of Christianity is also not really without foundation. I mean, the New Left is, you know, much more secular, and people are not, a lot of academic historians over the last 4 years have not been especially interested in the history of religion. A lot of them not been practicing Christians, or certainly not evangelical Christians, and have underplayed the role of Christianity. So I think, just to be perfectly fair, I think that criticism is not without foundation. At the same time, this interpretation that the the United States was founded as a Christian nation, that all the references to the Creator in the founding documents are part of a sort of a secret code among Christians, that that God gives rights, that God's hand can be found in the Constitution, that the Constitution is based on biblical law. This broad series of interpretations of the founding documents that have made their way through, for instance, the Texas School Board reforms, the social studies curriculum in Texas, which was revised this past year, to do things like remove Hobbes from the list of philosophers whose ideas influenced the founding of the United States and substitute Moses. That whole congeries of interpretations of the 18th century, there is not actually evidence for that. It's an interpretation that exists outside of standards of evidence that historians use. Those people who promote that interpretation, really, a lot of that stuff goes back to, like, this guy, Cleon Skousen, this Mormon guy, who's a big intellectual influence on Beck. It sort of refuses to engage in academic debate, where, you know, we would sort of say, okay, here's my interpretation of why I think that the United States was founded as a Christian nation, and then someone else say, no, here's my interpretation of why it was not. Like, there's actually no conversation between these two groups of people, and there cannot be, so long as people on the sort of Skousen side of the aisle are convinced that academic historians are part of a left-wing conspiracy to undermine American Christianity. So, I think part of the problem is that the impossibility for genuine conversation about that issue. I think it's a really quite an important issue.
All right, about 6 minutes left. Talk. You cover in your book the importance of newspapers back in the founding of the country. Talk about newspapers, the death of newspapers, and our current media landscape. How that is contributing to the situations we're seeing now.
I do think that the great untold and unreported story thus far about the birth of the Tea Party in 2009 is the death of the newspaper that same year. 40 newspaper employees were laid off every day in 2009, the year the Tea Party movement was launched and grew. And I think, again, there are many things that bring people into the Tea Party, a lot of just, you know, basic sort of old style Republican views of fiscal conservatism. And there are a lot of, there are also a lot of evangelicals who are drawn to this kind of Christian nation thesis. But I think a lot of people are yearning for a kind of community, a kind of community that we used to associate with the newspaper, and the way that the newspaper sort of was a celebration of the local. I also think it's the case that the United States and the newspaper as we knew it until fairly recently were more or less born together. Democracy and the newspaper have gone hand in hand from the start. And I mean, in the 19th century, you cut your ballot out of the newspaper with scissors, you know, like that's like literally they were hand in hand. And all, you know, the party system developed alongside partisan newspapers. You can't really study the history of American democracy without studying the history of the newspaper. And so that the newspaper is effectively dead. I mean, we have something now that is still called a newspaper, but I think it would be better to call it something else, because it's not actually what a newspaper was. I mean, I was like a newspaper delivery girl as a kid. I think I know what that meant, to have that morning paper. We also had an afternoon paper in my like little tiny town. To have lost that, is of course, that has introduced a political disequilibrium. I mean, the newspaper was part of the system, and now it's not there, so we're undergoing this incredible disequilibrium, and we'll get to the other side of it. We will have some kind of equilibrium. But meanwhile, we're kind of in this netherland where how democracy works without the newspaper is not yet clear.
Is that just unique to here in the U.S., the death of the newspaper?
No, I think that goes on around. I've had a lot of conversations with people, because I wrote a piece about the death of the newspaper that was published in like some Spanish anthology. So I have like these kind of international conversations about it. It offers a challenge, I think, to political culture in other communities as well. I think our particular history around the newspaper is an important one and worth paying careful attention to.
And do you think we can find community online with our portable electronic devices?
Well, you might disagree. I don't think I have found it. I think that online rewards adversarial opinion more than the newspaper did. Celebrates point of view, celebrates malice. I think there's also no proportionality on the internet. So one of the things that's lost in the death of the newspaper is you used to have an editor who would decide what's on the front page. Like, this is a significant story, it's going to be on the front page. No one decides that now. What decides that is what gets the most hits. I'm not really a believer in that as foretelling the most significant story.
Only a couple minutes left. One of the other things that one regularly reads in your book is the gatherings of people when significant events would happen back in the early days of this country. That seems to be something on the way out as well. You have events that are, you know, created by, you know, football or whatever, but it doesn't seem like people are getting so much together at public halls, things like that.
I do think people ask me often, I did an event here in Seattle last night and this came up as well. People are like, well, so where can we go to actually have a thoughtful and sustained debate with people with whom we disagree? And I put that question to the crowd, you know, where can you go to have that? I mean, I come from a family where I disagree with pretty much everybody in my family. We all disagree with one another. I can sit at the dinner table and we will have a heated political argument. That seems to me the fundamental working of democracy, right? So I actually love doing that. I think it's really important to argue. Like, I loved hanging out with these Tea Party people because, you know, there was a great deal of decency and mutual respect for the diversity of our opinion. And I think these people get slammed in the press for being intolerant. And I don't think that's fair because I don't really think there's a lot of conversation going on across these political divides. That is troubling, right? I mean, you actually have to be willing to sit down, and I don't mean swipe at people, which is actually pretty much all that happens on the internet. You actually have to listen.
All right. So, finally, what are you hoping to accomplish with your new book?
Oh, I don't know. I don't think I have any particular ambition for it. I just felt like I needed to stand up and say, okay, this is my little sort of snapshot of how this movement came to be and where it seems to me to come from. And I want to measure the distance between the 18th century and the present, because what the Tea Party's chief maneuver is just to collapse that distance. Oh, it's just like 1773. The Tea Act was just like that healthcare legislation. History doesn't work that way. Time marches forward and you can't collapse that distance. I want to sort of, you know, put on the page for the sake of really, finally, as an act of civic obligation, less than as an act of authorship. No, actually, the 18th century was a very long time ago.
All right. Well, with that, we're unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you very much for coming and spending time with us this morning.
Thanks a lot.
We've just been talking with Jill Lepore. She is author of the new book, Whites of Their Eyes, The Tea Party's Revolution, and The Battle Over American History.